Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today I am really pleased to welcome Bob Wiedemer to the program. Bob is the author of Aftershock, Protect Yourself and Profit in the Next Global Meltdown, which quickly became a New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestseller, and that, of course, came out before all of the big troubles hit. And just a month ago, his newest book, Aftershock Investor, another Wall Street bestseller, came out as well. Bob is the managing director of Absolute Investment Management, an investment firm that allocates capital based on his market insights. And I've met Bob before. We've talked extensively. We share a lot of similar views. I've asked and invited Bob here to discuss his latest macro outlook for the global economy. Are developments progressing as he predicted in his book? And what does he see coming next? I'm really looking forward to this conversation. And we'll hear his advice for the individual investor, where one can find safe harbor or even the potential for real gains. Where would you do that in today's market? So, Bob, there are a number of foundational similarities within your book and mine, and I know our views align somewhat, and I'm really looking forward to learning more. Welcome, Bob. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks, Chris. It's good to be on the show.
Listen, I want to start, you know, I did mention your book, Aftershock, but I think let's rewind that tape just a little bit further. You had an earlier book which talked about the bubble economy, where you were in your own Paul Revere mode, I guess, trying to warn people that there was something going on. What were you looking at then, and when did that book come out?
America's Bubble Economy was published in 2006. Well, I actually wrote that back in 2004. And through the early 2005, we wanted to delay publication because not enough of the bubble economy had popped that we thought anybody'd believe us and we'd get any sales. So we delayed it to 2006, which kind of worked out. But basically what we said in that book is that there were four bubbles that were working interactively to push up the bubble economy. And those were the housing bubble, the stock market bubble, the consumer spending bubble, and the private credit bubble. And a quick example of how these all work, you know, in a virtuous manner to boost the economy is like a home equity loan. As your house price goes up in value, you take out that home equity loan, you go out and you buy a car, or you buy other things, that helps boost the economy, boost the stock market, all works great, right? Until what we think would happen is that the housing bubble would pop, or, you know, any one of the bubbles could pop, but the housing was the one that popped, and that brought the rest of the bubbles down in a vicious downward cycle. And we said that it will be offset, though, by two more bubbles. It will essentially act as airbags, and that's the dollar bubble, or printing money, and the government debt bubble, you know, borrowing money, the government borrowing money. And this is what we talked about more in the aftershock. In fact, the aftershock is when those two bubbles pop. Right now that hasn't happened, but we're still popping up those two bubbles, just as we predicted earlier. In fact, we've added, since 2008, almost $2 trillion, or more than almost tripled our money supply. And we are now borrowing over $1 trillion more per year, which is about a 600% increase in borrowing per year by the government what we had prior. So we have done that. We've done exactly as we said. We pumped up the money supply. We borrowed a tremendous amount of money, and it's had the effect of helping to keep those bubbles up, just as we said. But it doesn't, you know, reinvigorate the economy so much as really help keep the bubbles up. I guess it depends how much borrowing and printing you do. But the problem is, of course, you've now got two new bubbles, and we think those will pop. And when those pop, you'll get the aftershock. So, and when that happens, of course, all the other bubbles come down as well.
Well, that's a strain of thought which says that you can't really ever escape the effects of a bubble. You know, Greenspan was famous for saying you couldn't spot one in advance. You could only deal with it after the fact, which seems a little bit self-serving or ignorant or both. I'm not clear on which it was. How do you see that?
Well, I don't think Greenspan wanted to see the bubbles. And that's why they're so hard to spot. It's because people don't want to see them. They want to think they're real. They want to think they're making tons of money. I mean, come on, Chris. In reality, you know, how many people wanted to see their house values collapse? How many people wanted to see stock price go down? We all thought it was real money. I mean, Bob Shuler does a Case-Shiller Index. He did a survey of Californian homeowners. And I think this was back in, like, 01, 02. And basically the majority of them thought that the average increase in their home values for the next 10 years would be 20% per year. We all want to think it's real. And that includes Greenspan. He wants to think that we're not really in a bubble. That's why they're so hard to spot. And I'd say the same is true today. We don't want to see the bubble we're creating with all that printed money and with all that borrowed money by the government.
I see it every day in the paper. People, journalists will write in Wall Street Journal, other places, New York Times, doesn't matter, and they'll say, oh, you know, if U.S. government borrowing was really excessive, we wouldn't see interest rates at 1.6% on the 10-year or whatever number they're quoting at that point in time, as if the price itself were an appropriate signal. And they're failing to note something that you've already raised, which is that we have two new bubbles, which is fresh money printing supporting fresh government debt purchases, with the Federal Reserve stepping in and influencing, or whatever word we want to call, forcing or manipulating the price of money through the interest rate market. We're not really getting real signals out of those markets, are we?
No, and that's exactly right. Plus, the other thing is that, you know, let's face it, if you had told that same person that we'd be borrowing over $1 trillion a year in 2005, he'd tell you that you're nuts and crazy, and that would never happen. So what's happening is people tend to like to assume that what is currently, you know, happening is normal and reasonable, but that's part of that bubble mentality, right? They don't want to see the bubble. And you're absolutely right. The borrowing bubble is being made possible by the fact that we're buying bonds. That absolutely will keep rates low. And in fact, you know, it means that you really could never have a government debt meltdown in the traditional sense of, let's say, you have a failed treasury auction. I mean, if Fed or whoever's head of the Fed is going to always buy the bonds that the government issues, well, there's always a market, right? And as long as that never creates inflation, I guess you could say that that's fine. In fact, you could ultimately just get rid of all taxes and just borrow all your money, right, Chris? And then, you know, have the Fed buy all the bonds. As long as it doesn't create inflation, that's fine. It's just that, of course, I think it will. And, you know, what's enabled all this borrowing is the fact that the Fed's been willing to go in, starting in 2009, and save the government's borrowing ability.
All right, so you spotted the bubbles coming in advance, and you were one of the few who did that right. And then it all comes down quite kind of as you expected, and then you write this book, Aftershock, also has done extraordinarily well. What's the main thesis in Aftershock?
The main thesis in Aftershock is that you know, these bubbles, this dollar bubble and this government debt bubble, will burst, and you need to be prepared for it. May not happen tomorrow, may not happen, you know, next year, but it will burst. Probably, you know, it's not going to be your grandchildren's problem. That's the thing we emphasize. It's not like, oh, well, it won't burst for 15 or 20 years. Then we say somewhere, you know, 2 to 4 years, could be a bit longer, but you're going to see problems even before then. But the big thing is that, you know, this is all being held up by you know, unsustainable economics. You know, you cannot keep borrowing and printing and expect that nothing will go wrong. Otherwise, you know, why didn't we just do this 10 years ago? Heck, we could have boosted our economy an extra $1 trillion worth of borrowing. We're only doing it because we're forced to now. Don't think that makes it right. Don't think that means it's going to work. It's just that, you know, the government authorities still forced to do this as a way to sort of bail out the bubbles and keep them from popping. And so you got to kind of see the economy for the reality it is, not that it's going to collapse tomorrow, but that, you know, it is being based on those big four bubbles that are being held up now by the two new bubbles. Not that, though, we've been borrowing for a while, but now we're borrowing a whole lot more per year, and that will burst. And that's just the reality. It's you're not going to be able to keep it up forever, and I don't think you'll be able to keep it up for more than 2 to 4 years.
You know, I have this theory, Bob, which is that if you could print your way to prosperity, we'd all be speaking Latin, because the Romans would have figured it out. They were very clever, did all kinds of incredible things. They build roads you can still drive on, which seems to elude us, at least in my part of the world. So I'm thinking that, you know, if you can't print your way to prosperity, I agree with your central thesis that these bubbles have to burst. It feels to me like the Federal Reserve is now stuck. They've painted themselves into a corner. And by which I mean, it's not possible for the Federal Reserve to suddenly and aggressively start raising interest rates, because that will completely destroy the government funding apparatus at this stage, would be one way we could look at that. So let's talk about these bubbles bursting then, and what you think that's going to look like, whether that's in 2 minutes from now, 2 weeks, 2 years. It's somewhere coming along. Do you want to, is this one big burst you want to talk about, or do you want to separate the dollar bubble from the government debt bubble?
Unfortunately, you can't really do it, because that dollar printing is an enabler of the government debt. And again, you know, not only in theory, but in practice, if the debt will always be funded as long as the Federal Reserve stands willing to buy all the bonds that, the government sells. So what really happens then is the real defining bubble is that money printing bubble. At some point, that creates inflation, and that pushes up interest rates. When that happens, and again, you know, the Fed will fight those interest rates going up. At first, they can do it. They just print more money, right? That keeps interest rates down, but ultimately that inflation comes up, we'll force them up. Just as we had in the early, late 1970s and early 80s, even before Volcker started cutting back on money supply, our interest rates are going up with inflation. And you're absolutely right. We can't just, pull the money out and raise interest rates now. They certainly would never want to do that because that's just going to pop the real estate and stock bubbles. That would be terrible. So what's going to happen is the Fed's going to lose control of those interest rates. It's going to lose control, essentially, of being able to control interest rates by printing money. When you print too much money, it's basically a recipe for not getting control. Because you control short-term, it's a recipe for losing control long-term. So as interest rates going up, what's going to pop the stock market and real estate bubbles, all that is what basically kicks off the big problem going forward. So normally you would say the bond market's going to be the problem, but I would tell you that it's actually going to be more stock and eventually even real estate combined, and then ultimately the bond market starts to go down. And it goes down fairly quickly once it starts going down, because what's happening is just as everybody doesn't want to see a bubble today, it's amazing how quickly they'll see the bubble once it really does start to burst. Just like housing. I mean, nobody wanted to see that bubble. Once it started to pop, people did start to, change fairly rapidly. And people, the housing values went down pretty rapidly. So in this case, I think it'll be even faster. Yes, the government will try to intervene for a while, but most of that intervention will work to kind of keep the bubbles up. But when the dam finally breaks, it will break fairly quickly, in literally a matter of months or certainly no more than a year once it really starts to go.
I think that's a fascinating idea. We saw that some of the big players, like Goldman Sachs, were edging away from the housing market as early as 2006 by taking, the other side of the CDS trades that they'd created and whatnot. So some of the big players were positioning themselves. They saw it as well. The housing market, though, has this other dynamic, which it takes time for prices to fall because it's actually real people holding very illiquid assets relative to big players holding on to extraordinarily liquid assets, meaning bonds, right? Those things can be traded in a microsecond if necessary. So I could agree that this, when it starts to unfold, it'll probably go fairly rapidly. And how will the Fed fight this? So we have a bond market route. The Fed's been fighting it as long as they possibly can. They're trying not to let interest rates go up. Suddenly the Fed, as usual, has to follow, not lead the market. It's following the market up, but at some point that creates extraordinary difficulties for federal financing, state financing, housing market prices, stocks, everything. How do you see that playing out?
Exactly. Well, you've got it. What happens is it becomes a much more difficult battle over time because, basically what you're having is that, the people are losing a lot of money on the bonds they bought earlier. They're falling in value. Many number of people want to sell. There's really no market for them. The Fed has to print money to buy them. You're also finding that some foreign investors are getting increasingly worried about all this. They're selling U.S. bonds. The Fed has to buy them, which it will. And basically, the Fed's starting to print an enormous amount of money. And that's why you ain't seen nothing yet. QE1, QE2, QE3, it's nothing like what the Fed has to do when this thing starts to fall. They've got to print and buy and buy and buy and try to keep up the falling house. They won't be able to do it. But that will be the reaction. And it means that you kind of keep it up for a while, but ultimately it is like trying to keep up a house falling on you. Sort of maybe hold it up, but eventually you're crushed. And so the Fed will do all sorts of things, printing money to try to keep that foreign money in, to try to keep the bond market stable, to try to finance the government, which is having increasing problems. And ultimately it doesn't work. You get very, very high inflation and pretty quick, they can't keep the stock market up. They can't keep the real estate market up. As you say, that takes longer to react. But ultimately, the interest rates go up. The massive amounts of having to print, it's pretty obvious to everybody that the jig is up. And then it basically pops. Now, during this, we could have stock market holidays, things like that. People may say everything's rebounding or we'll just solve the problem of short sellers or high-frequency traders. But you've got a more fundamental problem, and it's not going to get solved. And ultimately, the original asset bubbles all pop. But now with a whole lot of inflation added on top of it, and now with a government that has, basically has gone bankrupt because, their debt, how do they pay it at that point? Printed money? It just doesn't work. So, big difference between now and the Depression is that the government is also in trouble at this point. And we're really not going to have a huge failure until the government, kind of comes to its wit's end. And that it will. But it comes into a last massive orgy of money printing to try to save everything, and at some point it's not going to work, and the whole thing goes. you can keep it going for a while, and then, you know, one last blast of money printing, and it's kind of over.
Let me test that. So I'm thinking back to the 70s, late 70s, and you have Paul Volcker. He had to make some pretty hard decisions. Only Fed chairman ever to have been burned in effigy on the Mall in Washington. you know, so he took some pressure, obviously. But here's the thing. The Fed isn't like GE, a big diversified company with an awesome product portfolio. They've got one product. It's the dollar. At some point, doesn't the Fed have to choose between destroying its only product, the only thing that's in charge of, the dollar? It has to choose between defending that or enabling what the politicians want on the other side. One of my critiques of the Fed is they've gotten very politically cozy and operate more like a political function than a monetary function. But where do you see them, like, push comes to shove? Does the Fed really, really print, or do they go all Paul Volcker and reel everything in and let things come crashing down in an attempt to preserve the dollar?
Yeah, I think in the end they're going to really, really print. And we found that's been true in past history. I think it'll certainly be true today, because at any given time, Chris, if you pull the plug out, even today, as we were both talking, if you pull the plug out and you decide, well, we're not going to buy anymore, we're going to sell all our bonds back, interest rates start to soar, and the stock and bond market, stock bond and real estate markets all come tumbling down. 2 years from now, it's even worse. You're even more vulnerable, and it's harder to pull that money out. And when you put $2 trillion out, and now we're already on basically almost guaranteed to put out another trillion over the next year with QE3 and probably more after that, it's just too tough. You've locked yourself, as you said, between a rock and a hard place where you really have no good alternative. If you pull the plug, the impact is increasingly so big that it's sort of unthinkable, and so you continue going down the path until it basically melts down around you and, yeah, takes the dollar with it. Now, again, I've always wanted to say the dollar won't become worthless, but it will become worth a lot less. And, you know, it doesn't take much before it you know, basically kills the stock, bond, and real estate markets. If you took $1 you have in your pocket today and turned it into 10, that would pretty much be it for all three of those markets. So even though I think we'll have high inflation, it doesn't take that much inflation to really knock the heck out of our markets today. They're not anticipating much of any inflation.
Well, let's take where we are in current reality. One of the great surprises in my life has been seeing just how long this charade has been able to go on. If you'd take me, Bob, and you know 5 years ago, you'd taken Chris from 5 years ago and said, hey, here's where the Fed balance sheet is going to be, I would have thought you were nuts. And would have expected some fairly significant impacts. But here we are. Inflation is apparently pretty tame right now. The stock market has been magically levitated, the S&P sort of hugging the 1400 mark right now, which isn't too bad. And so some might say, look, it's working. What do you say to that?
Well, just what I said in my, I guess, introductory piece, it is working, right? And there's, when you pump up those two bubbles, it will work. And that's the whole point. It does work. Is it? And if you wanted to get, I mean, frankly, Chris, if I wanted to get housing sales back up to $2 million, print me enough money right now, and I could do it. You want me to? Can we borrow another $500 billion instead of $1 trillion? Let's borrow $2 trillion. Yeah, we could do that too. And it will work at first. It's just that what happens at a certain point, enough people all get together and say, "Hey, I think this is fundamentally going to blow up." Right now, what everybody's saying is, "You know what? We're just getting through a down cycle. We'll all come out of this, and it'll be fine. And we'll be able to reduce our deficits, reduce our money printing, and we'll all be fine." Is they're sort of assuming this is just sort of a big down cycle. And what I'm saying is, no, fundamentally, it's a bubble pop. You're just pumping up bubbles, and it's not going to it's not going to upcycle. By the way, you guys never said we're in an upcycle now. We'll just be in a down cycle in 5 years. They didn't say it in 2005 either. They kind of know it's not really a cycle. They're just hoping beyond hope that it is a cycle. We'll just cycle out. And I'm saying you're not. You're just pumping up bubbles. It's going to pop. But yes, it does work for a while. And again, we can print more money, and you're not going to see inflation. I think inflation is higher than it's being reported. I'm not the only person who's saying that.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of ways you can keep it down. But ultimately, even if you got bad reporting and all that, if what I'm talking about is true, you will get inflation that everybody can see, will become obvious, and will ultimately, you know, panic the markets, essentially. And that's the kind of the destiny you're going down. But yes, it will work now, and it will work for a while. As I said, it would. As we said, it would America's bubble economy and aftershock. This stuff works initially. And initially, it doesn't just mean 6 months. It can be years and years. And if anything, you know, will probably be, if I'm wrong, it will be that it, you know, as you said, it lasts a bit longer than I expect. Maybe lasts more than 4 years. But I think we'll find there's a lot of problems before then, just as we found there's been some problems in the economy now. Even though it is working, it ain't working perfectly even the last few years. We've still got a troubled economy.
obviously there's some cylinders that aren't quite firing in this story. And so we have this macro backdrop now, which includes the idea that we've been a serial bubble nation and all bubbles tend to burst, and without exception so far, historically speaking. You've painted a picture that there's all we've really done is traded the past bubbles for the next ones. And by the way, these bubbles just get larger and larger and larger. You take a NASDAQ bubble and replace that with a housing bubble and replace that with a government bond bubble, and you can just see the trajectory of this story. So we've got all that in the backdrop. Here we are. You're saying on one hand, we might be waiting for inflation, so we're watching out for those signs. Look, here we are. It's almost 2013. What are you looking out for here? Are you just trying to ride the wave until you see clearer signs, or is there something you're really keeping an eye out for as you look into this next year?
I think of the next year, it really will be just riding it through. I'm not worried about a big panic in the coming year, to be honest. I think we're going to ride through it. I think that if $40 billion a month, which they've pledged to do in QE3, of money printing, of bond buying, I think if that doesn't work, they'll raise it to 70 or 100 billion a month. And this will have some positive effect. Does that mean it's going to push the economy, the stock market to 16,000? No, probably not. Will that keep it from going below 10,000? Quite possibly. And that's the whole idea. And I think the Fed will react if the stock market has big problems or anything like that. It'll react by printing more money. So that's what I'm not that worried about this year. And that's kind of the weird part of this whole process, Chris, is that, you know, you basically keep doing this until you can't. And once you can't, everything changes very rapidly. And when people lose faith that this is going to work, it can go very, very quickly. Because it doesn't take 100% of people to change before the market really starts that problem.
Right.
So 20 or 30% change, as we all know, everybody else can't get up to score at the same time. So I think we're going to find people are still hoping this year things turn around. I don't anticipate a huge problem, but again, that doesn't mean I'm a big fan of the stock market right now. But I'm also not shorting bonds right now either. Could change. 6 months I might start shorting bonds, but I'm not now.
Excellent. And where does gold fit into your strategy, maybe silver too, or other resources as you look into this?
Very, very important. I think, you know, gold has done well. That's one of the great things about gold, as opposed to, say, shorting a stock market or a bond market, is you could have lost a lot of money doing that, shorting either one the past few years. With gold, heck, it's done great. We've been up 10%, you know, last year. We'll probably be up 10% this year. We're up over 400% since 2001. It's been a real, and that was, by the way, up every year, as I'm sure you know very well. It's been up every year since then. So it's been a great player in the past. I think it will continue to be. I mean, if gold can do this well in a period of low inflation and, you know, stock market's been okay, hasn't gone anywhere, but hasn't collapsed, the bond market has actually been pretty good. What would happen if those changed? And if we had high inflation, not so good stock market, and a bad bond market, I think gold could do very well. So I'm still very bullish on gold. I like it. Certainly a big part of our portfolio. So I'm pleased with that. I'm also pleased with silver. Silver has a lot of volatility. So I still think long term it will do well. But on a shorter term basis, you know, we're still down from, I guess, what our peak back in spring 2011. So, you know, I think silver will do well long term, but gold has just been a lot less volatile, so I generally tend to much prefer that. Other commodities, you know, agricultural commodities are great. I think they've done well over the past. I think they'll do well in the future if our dollar falls. I think ag commodities will do well. I think that those kind of commodities do well. The one issue I have with, say, oil, although I think that could be good, oil or other metals, they're affected in the recession, particularly, you know, if China slows down. That's driven a lot of the demand for metals and oil in the past, and certainly the past few years, I should say. If that demand slows down a lot, that could hurt some of the metals and oil. But again, a falling dollar, you know, this could be a really weird situation, could help domestically produced oil and natural gas. So it's kind of a weird situation. But commodities overall, I think, are an interesting play, but a lot of the demand last year has been driven by China. I think that's going to slow down a lot over the next years.
Yeah, I get that. So I do like silver as well because it's my Rip Van Winkle metal. It's an extraordinarily beautiful industrial metal. We use it, we consume it, we pull it out of the ground. It gets lost at the molecular level into the oceans or wherever it goes, and that's that. So as long as we can keep pulling it out of the ground, that's awesome. And it's got a story of scarcity built in. If you wander over into the mining sector and look at ore grades, look at known deposits, look at rates of extraction, you say, oh my gosh, there are not that many years left before all known deposits are gone. And maybe we'll find others, but the story that's inescapable at this point is falling yields. off of ore grades. And so there's just a story of depletion, eventually scarcity showing up there for me, which of course translates into price at some stage. So that's one of the reasons I like it. More broadly, are you looking at the idea of resource scarcity as you go out through the years and decades?
I am, but in maybe a somewhat different way, in that I think there's definitely resource scarcity. As I'm about to publish an article, I mean, the days of, and we all kind of know it in this, but it does prove it, the days of $3 barrel oil are long gone. You know, the days of 10 cent per 1,000 cubic feet natural gas are long gone. It's all going to get more expensive. As you said, what did you just say? Ore grades going down. What does that mean? That essentially means it's getting scarcer or more expensive to extract. I mean, yes, you know, somebody, I forgot the exact number, but in a cubic mile of ocean water, there's a lot of gold, but it's pretty difficult to get it out of there. So it means it's very expensive. So I think we'll see, you know, the cost of getting those resources going up. Yeah, we'll be able to, you know, find, you know, we'll be able to work with lower, you know, lower yield ores. We'll be able to work with lower yield oil and gas deposits. But it's all going to come at a cost, Chris. So, I mean, those costs are going to go up. On probably all of our resources, you know, from helium to iron ore to oil and everything in between.
It's an interesting part of the inflation thesis, because a lot of times inflation, well, the Fed and the government only track inflation through its terminal impact on prices. There are a number of things, obviously, that can push prices, and scarcity is one of them. And let's just wander over into the energy sector, which you mentioned for a minute. All the people I talk to in the oil and gas business, they say, listen, the Bakken plays have been there. We've been drilling them since the 50s. They've been very marginal. We've had fracking for 20 years, multi-stage fracking. We've had horizontal drilling for 30 years. What we didn't have was $75, $80 a barrel oil so that we could employ these technologies there. And so that's just a story that says, listen, by the time you're doing these horizontal drills, 10,000 feet down, another 15,000 feet across potentially, 20-stage frack, you need pretty expensive oil to get there. And so that oil price then feeds over into prices. But that is a different impact than inflation. Inflation might be adding to that dynamic, but there is just a story here which just says certain resources are now becoming more and more expensive because they're more dilute, they're more diffuse, they're more distant, they're deeper, whatever those things happen to be. And so that starts to play into this. One of the things I'd like to get your point of view on, though, is that we've built an entire credit market system, how the world is supposed to work. We've blown serial bubbles all with the idea that we could safely ignore resources. They'll be there. You know, if prices go up and, you know, that will create a certain amount of demand and supply will follow. And so the idea here that I want to sort of tease out is in your mind, when you look at the efforts to reignite the credit bubble, I see potential resource scarcity as just, it's more sand in the gearbox. Does that fit into your view? And what I'm trying to get at here is what's the chance that we're going to be able to get the animal spirits back? We're going to be able to reinflate, not one, not two, but maybe all four of those virtuous bubbles that you'd articulated all the way back at the beginning of this. What's the chance that we're going to get that firing up again?
Okay, number of issues here. Let's just deal with that last one first. Can we reinflate the bubbles? You can by pumping up those other bubbles, but ultimately, the more you pump those up, and we both know it, if we really did try to basically borrow our entire federal budget every year, we'd scare people. We'd scare people in the U.S., investing in the U.S., we'd scare people overseas. So we know that you just can't go too far. Just as if we printed $500 billion a month, we'd scare people, and you also find we'd get inflation pretty fast. So we can kind of pump them up. We can sort of stabilize them, is what I said before, but I think it'll be fine. It's hard to really pump them up without scaring people that you're inflating those other two bubbles too much, too fast. And so I think it's, you know, theoretically we can do it. I think in practicality it's just not going to work because, again, the only way you're inflating them is you're kind of pumping them up from something else. How does resource play into it? Well, absolutely. No matter what happens, resources are getting more scarce. And you're absolutely right. We do have a lot of oil in oil shale. We do have a lot of gas in gas shale. But it's expensive to get out. My dad was in oil and gas drilling back in the 50s. And, actually, hydraulic fracking is what they used even back then. It's 60 years old. It's nothing new. What's new is exactly right. We've got higher prices now for natural gas and oil. I mean, when he was working it, it was 10 cents, 1,000 cubic feet. Now, even the cheap price is $3 or $4. So all of that helps make a difference. Now, I think my guess is most of that gas shale isn't profitable until $6 a thousand cubic feet. But, you know, the point is what you're saying is quite true. Those resources are getting thinner. They're going to, our costs, basically due to supply and demand. Supply is getting tighter. Demand's still, you know, relatively high compared to your supply. You're going to have higher prices, and inflation will be on top of that. I mean, that's a real price increase. So all that is salt in the gearbox, as you said, or sand in the gearbox, sorry, salt moon, sand in the gearbox. And it makes the situation even more difficult. But fundamentally, what's really going on is, you know, you're trying to pump up bubbles that ultimately can't last, and you're doing it by creating other bubbles that will pop, and it just makes the whole situation much worse. It's just like somebody who's trying to save their business by borrowing and borrowing more money without fundamentally solving the problem of why is this business losing money. He's just making the situation a whole lot worse in the end.
So that's probably an unanswerable question, but does the Fed have a game plan here? The story you've just articulated says there's no exit to this thing. The question is, you know, how bumpy is the road between here and there? Potentially we're making the road even bumpier by just adding more fuel to the fire, as it were. So there's more imbalances and dislocations that have to ultimately be reconciled at some point. If you're painting a picture that says we fundamentally overdid it, and now we're going to have to re-equilibrate, find that new equilibrium, which is at a lower point, potentially live below our means to account for the years we lived beyond our means. Do you think the Fed is aware of this? And if so, what's their plan?
I think the Fed is aware of it, honestly. I think they do know that this is what they're doing is not something they'd like to do. I think they felt forced to do it, especially in 2009. I think they felt they had to do it to save the financial markets. What I think they're hoping is that, again, we're just in a down cycle, and it will cycle out. Just like the good banker, you know, let's say somebody you lent money to, he got stressed out, downturn, problem in the economy. So rather than pull his credit, they're going to give him more. You're trying to give him more to get through the downturn. And then when the downturn's over, this guy's making money again, he pays you back. And I think that's kind of what the Fed's sort of thinking is they're giving a little stimulus, a little boost to get through the downturn, and then they'll be able to pull that money back when it gets better. The reality is, exit plan, hey, you know, we actually used to talk about an exit plan after QE1. You know, how are we going to pull this money back out? We don't even talk about it anymore. The Fed doesn't mention it. I don't see it much in the financial press. There is certainly no exit plan talked about. There used to be. It was an issue. Now it's not. So I think we're kind of seeing the reality of it, and the Fed ultimately is increasingly stuck, because anytime you try to pull that money back out, you're going to instantly start to throw the bond markets, stock markets, and real estate markets into trouble. And they don't want to do it. They're hoping, they just keep, you know, just like a good banker who maybe is starting to throw good money after bad, you know, hoping that by giving his client more money, he'll get through the downturn, and then when he gets back out, he'll get his money back. But I think just like regular banker, the central bankers are, you know, in the U.S. are going to eventually start getting more and more worried. I think they already are. In fact, they're not talking about exit plans to tell you that, you know, their view of their, you know, reality of this money printing is changing. It's harder to get it back out once you put it in. We might have both thought that was obvious a few years ago, but for the Fed, I think they felt pressure to do this because their client, you know, like a bad business, was going under. They felt pressured to save them. And now they're hoping that business will turn around. I don't think it will. It's bubble business, not a real business.
All right, so the Fed's main strategy is hope, and that's okay. They have a backup plan, which is panic.
Well, I might quote you on that one in an upcoming book. That's awfully good.
All right. I think we've summarized that all in a sentence. So, all right. Most important question I have to know now. All right. So let's pretend I'm somebody, I'm listening to this, and I'm a private investor, and I'm thinking about shelter at this point. How am I going to protect what I've got? Maybe preservation of purchasing power, or maybe even how do I grow my wealth? Because I'm in a position where I actually need to find ways to grow my wealth, and that should be a legitimate goal of investing at all points in time, not just protecting it. What do you say to a person who's listening with those concerns?
Well, okay, first, the first preservation of capital is not always compatible with growing your wealth. I agree it's a reasonable demand, but let's say you're 1928, when Charlie Merrill Lynch came out and said, guys, get out of the market, you know, I think this market's in trouble. Now, he was wrong. You know, 1928 actually worked out pretty good. Most of 29 worked out pretty good. Now, we know the last part of 29 didn't work out so well. Charlie was right. But he didn't say, let's get out of this market and then let's move into this market. You know, there's a bull market, in, you know, born every day or somewhere in the world. He didn't say that. He said it's time to pull out and preserve. And in that case, it turned out to be pull out and preserve for years and years and years. Stock market really didn't come back, you know, until the late 50s and early 60s. So, I mean, in terms of, you know, making money, even then it wasn't a barn burner. So, you know, sometimes there isn't a great way to you know, make a lot of money in difficult times. In this case, I think we're in a better situation than we were, say, you know, 1928. I think there are some ways to make money, but they're never easy. I do think gold is one good way. I do think shorting the bond market at some point will work. Don't do it too early. Shorting a stock market will work. I think there'll be some commodities plays that will be good, some agricultural commodities. But commodities are, you know, still going to be tricky. And so there's no easy way to do it. And what people really like is what they've had before, is a stock market where they just throw darts at the wall in 1980. And by 1999, you're basically up 1,000% in blue chip stocks. Heck, if you're in high tech stocks, you'd be up 2,500%. I think that's what they're really looking for. And I'm saying, I don't think you're going to get it. I think you can make money, but it's going to be being in things that are naturally difficult. Or socially difficult. I mean, the number of financial advisors who will tell you to put even 20% in gold is pretty few. Would have been a great investment the last 10 years, and they'll all agree with that. It's proven, but they'll say, in the next 5 years, forget it. I wouldn't put any money in gold. So it's uncomfortable from a lot of standpoints. I think at this point to make money, the days of making comfortable money are gone. And in some cases, Chris, for many people, it may be better just to go into capital preservation mode, as Charlie Merrill recommended in 1928, and not worry about making 5 or 10% a year. You know, that might just be better for some. Not great, but it might be the better alternative than having your money stuck in a stock and bond market that ultimately, you know, you lose a big chunk of your money.
Well, if we're being honest about it, stocks have gone nowhere for, I guess, about 12 years in nominal terms. In inflation-adjusted terms, it would be a different number, but maybe inflation and dividends sort of like cancel each other out roughly, and so we can...
For your mainstream stocks, but NASDAQ, Chris, you know, they're down 40%. Here's all NASDAQ stocks.
Right. So if stocks are not the path, one thing I'm really unhappy with is just how overvalued all the bond markets are, because the various central banks have gone out and basically crammed safe yields so low that all the other yields have followed. And so obviously if you're a pension, you're an endowment, you're somebody with an actuarial responsibility that has real impacts to it, and you've got 0% or something close to it in what we might term a safe yield, that just makes everything else just that much more unattractive. So that becomes really just an extraordinarily difficult problem. And I'd always expected that maybe the Fed, you know, if you want to cram interest rates down to 0% for a little while, 3 months, 6 months, but here we are. What are we, 4 years into this experiment? And basically anything under 1% is zero as far as I'm concerned. It's the same. So if there's really no safe place to put your money in the financial sphere, what else is available, especially for the big institutional investors? What do you do?
Well, I mean, I do think that, as I said, I mean, gold's actually proved to be relatively safe, and I think we'll do well in the future. Mm-hmm. In terms of, bonds and stocks, not so good. Now, for big institutional people, they can short these things more easily. I mean, you know, so I think some shorts will come up and be a nice opportunity in the next few years. But, again, not easy. Not easy to time that right. So I think there are ways to make money, as you mentioned. I mean, John Paulson and the shorting on the mortgage trade, this is the most profitable, lucrative trade ever. I think netted, John personally over, $10 billion, $15 billion? So you can make a lot of money on these things, but it's not comfortable money. It's not the money we used, how we made in the old days. So I think there are ways to make in the financial markets outside, in terms of hard goods. You really don't want to hold a bushel of grain. I'm not sure how well it's going to do, but you can hold them, those silver and gold. Both, I think, will do very well long term. Eventually, yes, ultimately stock and bond markets will come back. All depends how much we decide to damage them now. Every day we keep this money printing, we're damaging them further long term. But yes, eventually they will come back. But I think we've got a ways to go before that, because, I think we're going to decide to damage them an awful lot, unfortunately. And that's not good. Every day we do this is not good to help our long-term recovery. Kind of rambling a bit here, Chris, but yeah, I mean, in terms of things other than financial instruments, as you said, there's not an easy way to make a lot of money. I do think gold is probably the easiest and simplest of any of those, or silver.
Excellent. Well, I certainly concur with that, have for a while. And I'm just waiting patiently for the time when investing can come back, because obviously we're not really investing quite as much, in my view. We're speculating. How much is the Fed going to dump, $100 billion or $40 billion? That's a guess. So your book, most recent one, Aftershock Investor, I assume you're covering a lot of these principles in there, and people can find that, well, I assume, just about anywhere.
I think in Barnes & Noble it's in the Best of Business section through Christmas. It's certainly on Amazon. So pretty easy to find at most major bookstores, online, BarnesandNoble.com, all that. Yep, it's all out. Pretty easy to get hold of, fortunately.
Excellent. And if people wanted to follow you In other ways, do you have other venues that you write or communicate in?
We do. You can go to our website, aftershockpublishing.com. It's pretty easy to remember, aftershockpublishing.com. And we've got newsletters you can sign up for and audio conferences. So there's a lot of a lot of ways they can follow us.
Excellent. Well, Bob, it's really just such a pleasure to have you on and to hear your views, many of which I do concur with. And I just love the framing, which is that bubbles burst. That's all you really need to know.
All you need to know.
History's never dodged them before. The odds are low this time. So maybe you should have something in your own personal strategy besides hope. And just understanding is an important part of that. So thank you for helping us to understand these issues.
Thank you, Chris. It's been fun.